Okay. So today we'll talk about orthogonal functions. And so I'll start by describing results from Sturm-Liouville theory. Parseval's theorem. And finally, I'll talk about orthogonal polynomials. Okay, so why talk about orthogonal functions? So the main motivation is that they occur naturally in a wide variety of contexts. One place that they occur all the time is separation of variables. So for instance, a problem with cylindrical or spherical symmetry, you'll, in general, need to use orthogonal functions. And you'll do an example to see exactly how they arise, like that in your tutorial this afternoon. So today I'm going to talk about some of the general properties of these functions. So there's a wide class of these functions, each of which has their own particular characteristics. But there's no way I could cover all of the possible orthogonal functions and their relevant properties, which you can look up easily. But today I'm just going to tell you about what you should know, should remember without having to look up, because these properties are pop up all the time and are applicable to many of the orthogonal functions, not just specific types. Okay, so let's first talk about Sturm-Liouville theory. And this, so what do I mean by Sturm-Liouville theory? So we want to solve a class of differential equations, not just a single one, which I'll write as u lambda of x plus lambda wx, u lambda of x equals 0. So why do I call this a class of differential equations? So here, lambda is a parameter. And the goal of the problem is not only to determine the functions u, but also the allowed values lambda. So let me explain each of the terms in this equation. So here, omega is a differential operator. And we'll mostly be interested in second order differential operators. So u lambda, it's w first. So w of x is some positive weight function. And we want to solve this equation in an interval, a finite interval. For both the eigenfunctions and the eigenvalue. So that's the problem. And exactly this type of problem occurs all the time in separation of variables. Sometimes occurs otherwise in other contexts too, but that's the most common one. Okay. So this is our problem. And Sturm and Liouville proved that the solutions have a bunch of nice properties as long as we impose a condition on omega. If omega is self-adjoint. Or also in this context called Hermitian. So what I mean by that, that means that if I act with omega on one of these eigenfunctions and take the inner product with another eigenfunction with respect to the weight w, this is equal to u lambda times omega again u lambda prime with respect to w. So here, the inner product, I'm using subscript w. And what I mean by that is that the inner product of f with g with respect to w is equal to the integral in this, if we're dealing with this finite range, from a to b of f of x, g of x, w of x. So it's just a slight generalization of the inner product we talked about on Tuesday. The only difference is we multiply by this weight function, which has to be positive in order for the norm defined by this to be non-negative. Okay? So we need this. And few lines of algebra will show, and I encourage you to check this, that this condition up here, that omega is self-adjoint, for second order operators, if omega has this form, and we have separated boundary conditions. Which means that we're imposing something separately so we're imposing some condition on some linear combination of the eigenfunctions and its derivatives at A and separately at B. Okay. So these two are equivalent, and you can check just by doing some integration by parts. Okay, so what does this get you? So these two mathematicians proved that, in this case, we can learn a lot about both the eigenvalues and the eigenfunctions without having to do any more work. So the eigenvalues, so first of all, we learn that the eigenvalues are real and distinct. So there's some smallest eigenvalue, which is finite, and we can order them. And they're continuous, they're all finite. Okay. So I'm not going to prove this now. I do have some notes that if anyone is interested, I can put up on the wiki to describe where these results come from. Annabelle? Plus tx, yes. So here, s and t are just some functions. We also need to require, I think, that s has to be positive. But t here is just some general function. So if we start out with some differential operator, we can try to manipulate it to put it in this form. So that can be useful to do sometimes. But for any positive s and any t that are continuous, then as long as these conditions are satisfied, then we call this self-adjoint. Ruben?
So omega has to be self-adjoint according to that scalar product.
But that's right.
Does it have to be true for any two functions? Because you wrote down specifically two solutions. So should the Hermitian property be true for any function or only?
It should be true for any function. yes.
Okay.
So one of the consequences of this theorem I'm going to show is that, in fact, I was about to tell you that these eigenfunctions form a complete basis of the space. So it's equivalent in that sense. Okay.
Are there any constraint on the alpha 1 or beta 1?
If they're real, there's no constraint, which is the only case I'll be talking about. If they're complex, or if they're real, they can't both be zero. But if they're complex, we need. This. Yes. So these are some boundary conditions. So if we're going to try to solve a differential equation, we generally are interested in it with fixed boundary conditions. And so that's what we're looking for here, except here we are allowing the parameter lambdas to change. So we're not just solving a single differential equation, we're solving a class of differential equations. Yes.
So here the boundary condition, does it mean so for different lambdas, so the two equations still hold?
Yes, so this holds should hold for any lambda.
Alpha and beta.
Alpha and beta. So we're solving this problem on a fixed interval, finite interval from A to B. So B are fixed, and alpha and beta should be fixed as well. So another result we get from this theorem is that the nth eigenfunction has exactly n zeros. In the interval excluding the endpoints. And furthermore, the zeros of the n plus first eigenfunction are in between zeros of u lambda n. This will have one more zero. So we said that n minus one of the zeros will be in between the n zeros, and the last two will be between the first zero of this and A, and the last zero of this and B. So this property in particular is very useful for looking at qualitative properties of these solutions. So just using this property, we can learn a lot about, we can sketch a fairly accurate graph in some cases of what the solutions look like without doing any work, just if we check that this is satisfied. And the last property is one I referred to earlier, is that the U lambda n form a, if you normalize them appropriately, orthonormal basis. And that just means that this integral u lambda n of x with u lambda m of x times w is equal to delta nm. For some choice of normalization. So in general, there's an ambiguity at the overall scale of these. OK. So what we'll come back to, let's look at some examples of this in the tutorial this afternoon. Any other questions?
The property for so the zeros of u are in between the zeros of a sentence? Does
it
mean that the zeros are getting closer and closer to each other?
That's right, yes. So if we sketch what, say, our interval is from A to B, the first one looks something like this, have no zeros. The next one will have one zero. It's somewhere in it, in here, and the third one might look something. Second one, 0, 1. So this is n equals 0, n equals 1. Third one will have two zeros. And they'll be in between A and 0 of 1, and B and D, other 0 of 1. So I've been drawing this very carefully. I don't know. Well, I'm sure you could come up with one. Some weight functions of these are orthonormal, but the zeros will look something like this. And for three, there'll be a zero in this range, in this range, and in this range. So we have a finite interval. We're putting more and more zeros in there. So yes, they have to get closer together. So to note here, a crucial assumption is that this range is finite. For an infinite range, then things are different. Okay. So why else are orthogonal functions interesting? So another reason that they're interesting is for approximation. So certainly for numerical methods and sometimes for analytic methods as well. So let me be a little more precise. So let un be orthonormal. These could be the solutions to a Sturm-Liouville problem or just some general orthonormal functions. So let's suppose that we want to find the best approximation to some function f using the first, the 0 through n first orthonormal functions. U0 up through u capital N. So the best approximation is just the sum from n equals 0, okay, n equals n, of some coefficients times these functions. And the coefficients, in this case, are just given by the inner product of un with f. So let me sketch the reason why. It's a direct consequence of this through Parseval's theorem, which will give us some more interesting results. So let's look at the square error distance, which I'll define to be delta. What I mean by square error distance is the norm of f minus sum from n equals 1 to n, an un. Which is just the inner product of this with itself. Sorry, this should run from 0. So let's expand this out. So we can write this, the first term just gives us F squared. Then we have term here, AN times F with UN from this with this, and a similar term with AN conjugated. Let me write these as terms so we can clear which terms come from where. So again, gain by doing this. So this tells us that so these last three terms are almost a complete square. So let's try to write it that way. So this first term we can leave out, and then these last three terms all come from this. So we get this term, and I skipped a step up here. So this is equal to A M star A N, which U N, which is equal to, because these are orthonormal, just equal to sum from N equals 0. So we get these three terms directly from this, but we've added an extra term we didn't have before, which is just this, which we can subtract off, this squared. Okay. So what do we gain by doing this? So first of all, we note that all the terms are positive, which is good. So we started out with something that was manifestly or non-negative. And our choice of n only affects this term. So this is the only one we can change by our approximation scheme. And this term in particular is greater than or equal to 0. But we can easily make it be 0 by choosing the choice of an that I claimed. So that's the best we can do to approximate this. And furthermore, note that this an doesn't depend on any of the previous n's, which would not be true if we tried to do this without using orthogonal functions, because then we couldn't do this trick. Okay. So this result immediately leads us to Parseval's theorem. Which makes the additional assumption that the function space is complete. Okay. which means, in particular, that f approximated in this way converges. Okay. So if we look at our approximation that uses n terms, just from here, we see that this is f squared minus sum from n equals 0 to n un f. But this second term is equal to an squared. But we know that as n goes to infinity, this converges. So this difference between f and its approximation has to go to 0. So this delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So that means that f squared is equal to the sum n equals 0 to infinity of an squared. Okay, so how can...
Syntagmatic products are also made with a weight value, or...
They could be. So that wouldn't change any product. I just assumed that the weight was one here, but just added w to everything. You know.
Is that f real or complex?
F, so I've been assuming it was real. Would anything change? I'm assuming, I don't think anything would change if we allow them to be complex, but I'm not 100% certain. It's fine if we allow everything to be complex.
F
can
be complex. But you still use the real.
So if f is complex, then the u's will also have to be complex.
Also complex.
Yeah. So throughout today's lecture, I'm mostly going to be dealing with real functions. Tomorrow we'll talk a bit about complex functions. So that's what you would need to do if you wanted to change this proof to be complex. But for the real cases we're considering, you can just ignore that. Nicole?
When we say that the function space is complete, we mean that it includes all the events. What do we mean by that?
So it means that so we mean this. That we can write that if this goes to 0, if the distance with respect to the norm between a function and some series goes to 0 with respect to the norm, then it converges. That's what we mean by complete.
Converges in space, right?
Yes. Yeah. It means if delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity, then this.
Is the definition of converging?
I think to make it precise, you have to say converges in the space.
Yes, it converges, right, to an f in the space.
That's right.
In the space. The series converges to a limit in the space. So if we
like construct some functions fn, which are that sum up to n, and then you can say fn goes to f, where f is that.
Okay.
Where
yeah,
f is in the space.
It's just because when the f equals the series, it looks to me like f converges to f in the space.
Right. So this might not exist. Is
well, that, in that case, you would just say f equals that infinity exists in the space.
Yes.
In that case.
Yeah. There exists an f.
By the way, is the convergence of the f of fn to the function f is it pointwise or uniform? Is it current?
This is so. I've been talking about.
Yeah, but how does it converge?
Convergence in a sense of Cauchy, I think.
Okay, so let's look at an example here. So consider a wave, the amplitude. X period. Is there a question? Period L. So we have a periodic function. We know that we can expand it in a Fourier series. So what does Parseval's theorem tell us in this case? So intensity is the energy unit length should be proportional to 1 over the length times the integral of the amplitude squared. And so Parseval's theorem tells us that this should just be equal to the sum of all the Fourier coefficients. So in other words, the total energy is just the energy contained in each of the Fourier components, which is obvious if you state it in physical terms. But we can actually use this to derive some cool identities. So let's suppose f of x is x. Again, we're considering periodic, so we're looking at something like this. This distance here is L. And we can use Parseval's theorem to let's use Parseval's theorem to compute the energy in two different ways. So, first of all, U is 1 over L, L minus magnitude L over 2, x squared dx, just L squared over 12. And then we can sort of compute one side of this equality, and then we can try to compute the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients. So first of all, we note that the zeroth Fourier coefficient is zero by symmetry. And we can compute the nth by using our best approximation result. And so we can evaluate this integral by writing like this. Over, so if we put a derivative on the e to the minus 2 pi on x over L, ex, we need to bring out this factor to 2 pi I n, L times 2 pi I n. We already had an L, so we're left with this. And then we can integrate by parts. So we get so this is straightforward to evaluate. Now, we just get from here, a L over 2 times e to the pi I n plus e to the pi minus pi I n. And this is 0. So we're left with simplifying this, L over 2 pi I n times minus 1, n plus 1. OK. So what does this tell us? So if we use Parseval's theorem, it tells us that L squared over 12 is equal to the sum of our result from up there which is just L squared over 4 pi squared times twice the sum n equals 0 to infinity 1 over n squared. So we have two copies of this from the 0 to infinity and 0 to minus infinity. And if we rearrange this, we just get that pi squared over 6 is equal to the sum n equals 1 to infinity, 1 over n squared, which, as we'll see tomorrow, is what I'll define to be the zeta function evaluated at 2. So we computed this exact result using this method. And you can use it to find the sums of other series as well. Any questions?
The second step there, the sum should be from n equals to 1 to infinity, right? Not from 0 to infinity.
Yes, thank you.
That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, so lastly, I'd like to talk about an important class of orthogonal functions.
In that case, would we also want to replace the nadir infinities with
No, so we did need to the positive and negative frequency. So here, yeah, this is correct. We should sum over both positive and.
In this case, we're arguing that A0 equals 0 anyway, so that term doesn't contribute. But yeah, that's still okay. Does that make sense?
Okay. So important class of orthogonal functions are orthogonal polynomials. And so I'm going to show you a few of the properties of orthogonal polynomials, and then we'll classify them all and show you how they're all come from the same place. So we know polynomials form a complete basis. So if we want to construct these, the simplest thing we can try to do is orthogonalize using standard Gram-Schmidt procedure. So we can start with our first polynomial, P0 of x, just define it to be constant. And if we want these also to be orthonormal, then we should normalize everything. And so this is with respect to an arbitrary weight. Then, if we've already constructed n orthogonal polynomials, we can construct one more by first constructing a degree n plus 1 polynomial by multiplying Pn by x, and then subtracting off its projection onto all of the other previously constructed polynomials. Okay, and if we want, we can normalize these with if we want them to be orthonormal, we just choose this to be the norm of the top here. What does this gain us? So we see immediately from this construction that all of these polynomials have a recurrence relation. So how do we see that? So we look at the sum a little more carefully, we can see that most of the terms in that sum are in fact zero, all but two in particular. So how do we see that? So we can just use the definition of our inner product. So we look at this term. This was just defined to be but we can move the x over here. And note that this has to be 0 for I less than n minus 1, because by assumption, the nth polynomial is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. And this is a degree I plus 1 polynomial. So that's implies by our Gram-Schmidt formula that Pn plus 1 is equal to some coefficients times x Pn plus Bpn, Bn Pn plus Cn Pn minus 1. So all of these polynomials will have some sort of recurrence relation like this. The exact coefficients will depend on which polynomials you're looking at. Okay? So let's try to come up with a better formula for these polynomials and determine which ones are allowed. So this is just a normalization factor if you want them to be orthogonal. Okay. So what we want to find are polynomials Pn such that this integral zero for b equals 0 up to n minus 1. So let's see if we can guess a formula. And to do that, let's look at a few simple cases to see if we can get any inspiration. So this case means we want to go from A to B of P1 of x, W of x, Px equals 0. So trying to guess a formula that'll work for any n, so let's try to be as general as we can here. So one way we can do this that will generalize nicely is if W times P1 is proportional to the derivative of some function y1, then we can integrate by parts, and we can we'll just get y at the boundaries. So if we make this assumption and require y1 of A and y1 of B both be 0, then we satisfy our condition. So the simplest way we can do that is to choose y1 to be proportional to x minus a times x minus b. It's the simplest function we can think of that satisfies these conditions. OK, let's see if our technique works for a more complicated case. We'll need to change. So let's look at n equals 2 and p equals 1. So we want integral from a to b of w p2 and x dx to be 0. So let's try something along the lines we did before. So w of x, 2 of x, proportional to, now if we integrate by parts once, we'll have to act on the dx, but if we choose it to be the second derivative, then the x doesn't matter. And so here, we want y2 of x to be proportional to y to x minus a squared times x minus b squared. So that it's not just a constant. So if we make these choices, this is 0 at the boundaries. We only have the boundary terms. And so P2 will be orthogonal both to x and 1, this choice. So let's, in general, if W times Pn proportional to the nth derivative of Yn and Yn proportional to x minus a to the n x minus b to the n, then check that this integral is 0 for p less than n. So we're getting closer. But what if a or b is infinite? Can we still do something like this? So can't just directly replace a or b with infinity in that formula for y I have over there. But if so let's just look at the case where a is minus infinity and b is finite, then yn, so for b, we're OK for that with that boundary. But for a, we want a function fn where fn goes to zero faster than this term goes to infinity at minus infinity. So we need it to go to zero faster than x minus b to the minus n at minus infinity. And similarly in the other cases, if they're both infinite or only b is infinite. Okay, so what does this tell us? So let's summarize what we've learned. So we found that w times pn of x equals the nth derivative of yn. Is orthogonal to all of the polynomials of degree less than n if yn is like x sn to the x times fn of x with s of x equal to x minus a, x minus b, if both are finite, x minus a or x minus b if only a or b is finite, and a constant otherwise. Okay. So this suggests the generalized Rodriguez formula. So we just rearrange the equation we have up there and define the orthogonal polynomials to be some normalization constant divided by w of x times the nth derivative of s to the n. Now, what about this fn? So we haven't really required much of this fn. It just has to go to zero quickly at plus or minus infinity. But we want this formula to give us a polynomial for every choice of for every n. So every time we're taking one more derivative, so we want this thing to just give us a polynomial of one higher degree every time we take an extra derivative. So it'd be nice if this f is just a single function, and it turns out we can choose it just to be w. So as long as w is finite and differentiable. And w of a, s of a, is 0. And similar for b. And it goes to 0 faster than any polynomial. And pass in any power of x as x goes to plus or minus infinity otherwise. So we need it to be faster than any power because we replace that fn with just a single function. OK. So we're almost done. So the only thing left to do is determine the allowed weights. So once we determine the allowed weights, we have an explicit formula for all of the orthogonal polynomials. So I claim that there are only three cases to check. And that's AB equals reals. F of reals or minus 1 to 1. So if we're interested in any other AB, then P n of cx plus d will be a polynomial in one of these ranges. So let's look at the first case. So what is our condition? So let's just check first that P1 is a polynomial. So if we want P1 to be a polynomial, then P1 has to be equal to some first order polynomial. But if a and b are minus infinity to infinity, we don't have to use this freedom to map our range onto to the range. So we can make a linear transformation. And get the P1 so this will be simplify things in a minute. Rodriguez formula for P1, we have that normalization constant for now. 1 over W dW dx is equal to plus or minus 2x. Very simple linear or first order differential equation to solve. And let me write down the solution. So two possibilities here. We need to check that they satisfy our boundary conditions. And so remember, boundary conditions in this case were that w of x had to go to 0 faster than any power of x as x goes to plus or minus infinity. And so that forces us to choose minus sign. And so found our result. This is equal to Cn exponential of x squared. So the nth derivative of e to the minus x squared. And so you may have seen this formula before. So if we choose Cn to be minus 1 to the n, then these are the Hermite polynomials. And so we've just shown that these are the only orthogonal polynomials on the real lines, on the real line. Okay. So, and there are two cases left to check, which I'll leave to tutorial. So you'll determine all of the orthogonal polynomials. Any questions?
Nicole?
Yes. Sure. So in general, we want P1 of x to be of this form. But we could also instead say demand that P1 of ex plus f has to be of this form. So if we want to be completely general, so we could allow ourselves to just demand that this is equal to cx plus d. And so for appropriate choice of if this is any linear polynomial of this form, we can choose e and f so that it has this form.
Just wanted to clarify a statement. So you say the Hermite polynomials are the only orthogonal polynomials on the real line?
Yes.
So what about the Legendre polynomials?
Those are defined on a different range. Those are defined on minus 1 to 1.
OK.
And have you shown that they are the only ones? Since we assume that f is of the form w, right?
Right. So that, yes. So you're worried about whether we could have different functions here for each
right.
of the polynomials. So this, so even if we let this just be some, yeah, right. So the issue then is getting polynomials for all n. I think if we look at right, so if we look at P0, then that gives us some information about. So P0 has to be a constant, which from our formula means that 1 over W times, if you let it be completely general, has to be just F0 is a constant. So that gives you a relationship between F0 and W. And right. It's not immediately clear that this is the only possible choice for F. At least to me, but it is true that this is. I don't recall exactly the argument for why that's the only choice, but it is true that this is the only choice.
When we were sort of started considering the problem, when we looked at P's with respect to a fixed W, and then by the end we've chosen a P and said what W has to be. Like,
right. We've chosen a range. So we determined this and demanded that the PNs give us an nth degree polynomial. And from that, and this assumption that F is equal to W, that allows us to determine W just by specifying the range. Does that answer your question?
Okay, so we're just trying to find some inner product where the PNs will be.
Right, that's correct. That's what
rather
we're trying
than to trying do. To find the polynomials for an inner product.
Well, once we determine W, this formula gives us the P's as well, up to normalization. Yes. So we can always make a linear transformation of the polynomials. So if Pn of x is a degree n polynomial, then Pn of ex plus f will also be a degree n polynomial.
And you were saying that even if we're just constants, there's nothing to be exponential.
Right. Yes. Before I called them C and D, but I used C and D here. So. These are just constants. So since this is also a degree one polynomial, all we really need is that this equation is satisfied. Does that answer your question? So that was a choice. It's a choice. If I chose something else, I would get the same answer. It would just be more complicated. I could go through and solve this and solve it just saying that this is ax plus b. And it would. We can choose it in this case. In the other cases, we need to use this to bring our range into one of our three cases. If we look at this equation, it's easier to integrate if we make the choice. Any other questions? Okay. See you this afternoon.